From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Big Brother is indeed watching, and apparently, he's a voyeur. That's the latest word from NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, testifying before the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe's parliamentary hearing in Strasbourg Tuesday via a video link from Moscow.
The UK Electronic Surveillance Service, GCHQ, collected on a massive scale images from web cameras, often within bedrooms, in private homes, without any individualized suspicion of wrongdoing. This activity continued even after GCHQ became aware that the vast majority had no intelligence value at all, and roughly 10% of all images upon auditing were discovered to be intensely private, depicting some form of nudity or other private intimacy. That the NSA had intentionally sought to collect similarly explicit sexual material regarding religious conservatives whose political views it disfavored and considered radical, for the purpose of exposing it to damage their reputations and discredit them within their communities. This is an unprecedented form of political interference that I don't believe has been seen elsewhere in Western governments. That no legal means currently exist to challenge such activities or to seek remedies for such abuses.
The former NSA contractor spoke before the council's session. He prefaced his remarks with a stark analysis of the state of whistleblower protections, or, more to the point, the lack of such protections in the U.S.
Due to failures in whistleblowing legislation in the United States, there are no legal channels available for individuals such as myself, who are employed as private contractors rather than direct federal employees, to safely testify in front of legislative committees. As such, I ask for your understanding in recognizing that despite the executive policy changes, legal reforms, and court decisions to improve the rights of others that have occurred as a result of my disclosures, I remain in a position of significant legal jeopardy. I believe last year showed that an expectation of persecution for political speech in the context of national security whistleblowing is not unreasonable.
Wanted in the United States on charges of treason, Snowden sparked a huge international scandal last year when he leaked classified evidence of American government spying programs to the media. According to Snowden, the information gathered is not limited to fighting terrorism.
Mass surveillance is used by the NSA, as well as partners and adversaries, for the purposes of economic espionage. NSA had unlawfully compromised the world's major financial transaction facilitators to include SWIFT and Visa, and in their reports, they explicitly noted that such information provided, quote, rich personal information, unquote, including data that, quote, is not about our targets, unquote.
In a statement on Monday, the European Council defended its decision to invite Snowden to testify, saying he had triggered a massive public debate on privacy in the internet age and that the testimony would hopefully illuminate, quote, what his revelations mean for ordinary users, how they should protect their privacy, and what kind of restrictions Europe should impose on state surveillance, closed quote. The council had also invited the White House to give evidence, but it declined. Iran and the so-called P5 plus one group, the U.S., Britain, Russia, France, China, and Germany, sat down to a new round of talks in the Austrian capital Vienna, the latest in an ongoing set of negotiations aimed at resolving the decade-long dispute over the Islamic Republic's nuclear energy program. The high-level talks were presided over by Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif and EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton, representing the P5 plus one group. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe reports.
Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany resumed nuclear talks in Vienna. Iran's foreign minister says drafting the final agreement will be a difficult task. Mohammad Javad Zarif has said that the remaining issues will be all dealt with during 2 days of talks in Vienna so that both sides could start drafting the final agreement in May. He described his talks with the EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton as useful, adding that both sides agreed on the necessity of moving forward on the basis of mutual respect. Zarif said the current talks will focus on issues that have not been tackled so far, such as the mechanism for nuclear inspections. On the recent anti-Iran resolution adopted by the European Parliament, Zarif said that any dealing with the Iranian nation should be based on respect, warning that such measures would stir skepticism on the Iranian side. Of course, my name is Mehdi Kazemi, is in Vienna, and he joins us right now to perhaps tell us more about these talks. Well, I mean, Mehdi, Michael Mann spoke, but he didn't say much. Can you add perhaps things that he did not tell us in terms of the talks going on there?
Well, of course, Kaveh, as the Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif mentioned earlier, no drafting yet between Iran and the P5+1. Talks will continue today and tomorrow, of course, in Vienna. And perhaps all sides will focus on preparing the grounds and the content of a draft, which, of course, follow the path towards the talks reaching a higher level and, of course, reaching a final deal between Iran and the P5+1 over Iran's nuclear energy program. But the Iranian foreign minister has also reiterated on a number of important issues, which, as you said, were not pretty much pointed to by Lady Ashton's speaker, Michael Mann, and that was that the mutual respect would be the most important factor, according to Minister Zarif, that would determine the direction of all talks between Iran and the P5+1. Mr. Zarif has also said that the Iranian delegation and the P5+1 during these round of talks, which are the third official round of talks in Vienna between both sides, will be discussing very important issues and very important documents. Perhaps they are referring to, as you earlier mentioned, to the way and the method that inspections could take place, mostly focused on Iran's Arak, a nuclear facility, which contains a heavy water facility and also a nuclear reactor, and how the inspections should take place in that area. Now, prior to the talks, Iran's deputy foreign minister and top nuclear negotiator, Abbas Araghchi, held meetings with his Russian and Chinese counterparts, and perhaps this refers to the significance that Iran considers for the role that Russia and China have to play in helping the talks go forward between Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany. And of course, the first round of talks today have already ended, and Mr. Zarif's deputies, of course, including Mr. Araghchi and Mr. Ravanchi and other deputies of Iran's foreign minister, are currently holding a session behind closed doors with Lady Ashton, EU foreign policy chief, in Vienna's Coburg Hotel. Now, all sides, according to the Iranian foreign minister, have agreed to take the talks to a higher level. That would include, to a great probability, it would include a drafting in the upcoming month, during May, but still there is no information regarding the exact date of those talks in May and where the location of that talks would be, whether they would be in Vienna or some other place.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has again accused the U.S. government of attempting to provoke a replay of the 2002 U.S.-backed coup in his country. He spoke with The Guardian's Seamus Milne in Caracas on Monday. We are facing a synthesis of all the counter-revolutionary coup models that have been previously mounted against the Bolivarian Revolution.
Could this be a form of color revolution that is being launched here like we've seen in other countries? Could Venezuela go the way of Ukraine?
This is part of a scheme of non-conventional war that the U.S. has perfected throughout recent decades by creating economic problems. They try to create social problems and political discontent so they can justify a climate that would explain the protests of civil society. They try to sell to the world that the protests are some kind of spring. We already had our spring, our revolution.
La revolución que le abrió camino
the revolution that opened the door to the Venezuela of the 21st century.
Said that you and Venezuela use them as a pretext or an excuse for your own failings. What's your evidence for the interference of the United States in the country, and what do you think their aim is?
100 years of intervention is not enough in Latin America and the Caribbean. 100 military interventions against Haiti, Nicaragua, Chile, Grenada, Guatemala, Brazil isn't enough. We have sufficient evidence. Some of it has been published by WikiLeaks, by Julian Assange. Others made public by Edward Snowden. They tried to destroy Venezuela, to get their hands on Venezuelan oil. But they've isolated themselves. Maduro added that the U.S. will not be the one to put an end to the Bolivarian Revolution. Los Angeles police officers tampered with voice recording equipment in dozens of patrol cars in an effort to avoid being monitored while on duty. This according to an article in the L.A. Times on Tuesday. An inspection by LAPD investigators found about half of the estimated 80 cars in one South L.A. patrol division were missing antennas, which helped capture what officers say in the field. The antennas in at least 10 more cars in nearby divisions had also been removed. Most of the antennas were removed from cars in the Southeast Division, which covers Watts, Jordan Downs, and Nickerson Gardens, where relations between police and minority communities have historically been marred by mistrust and claims of police abuse. The in-car video cameras had been touted as a powerful deterrent to police misconduct and a tool for defending officers against false accusations. A federal judge last year formally ended more than a decade of close monitoring of LAPD by the U.S. Department of Justice. The judge agreed to lift the oversight in part after lawyers for the city and police made assurances that LAPD had adequate safeguards, including the cameras, in place to monitor itself. LAPD's Chief Charlie Beck and other top officials said they learned of the problem last summer, but they chose not to investigate which officers were responsible. Rather, the officials issued warnings against continued meddling and put checks in place to account for antennas at the start and end of each patrol shift. Members of the police commission, which oversees the department, were not briefed about the problem until months later. According to the Times, some commissioners said they were alarmed by the officers' attempts to conceal what occurred in the field, as well as the failure of department officials to come forward when the problem came to light. Hoping to break the cycle of healthcare-related debt in the U.S., a group calling itself Rolling Jubilee has been buying medical debt from debt collectors and forgiving it. The operation is an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street. To date, Rolling Jubilee has used about $700,000 to extinguish close to $15 million of hospital debt of ordinary people. The group's mission, according to member Thomas Gocke, is to create a global debtors' movement. He spoke with Radio VR's Kels Hetherington about the group's work and the role that debt plays in American society.
So Rolling Jubilee is a project of Strike Debt. Strike Debt is an offshoot of Occupy Wall Street, and we are trying to create a global debtors movement. And the Rolling Jubilee is one tactic that we're using. Most people don't realize that debts are sold as a commodity on a shadowy speculative market, and banks, credit card companies, even hospitals sell personal debt to investors, whose only purpose is to buy this debt and collect on this debt, and these investors are literally getting rich by keeping other people poor and in debt. But the catch that makes a project like the Rolling Jubilee possible is that when this debt is being bought and sold behind the scenes, it's not selling for face value. It's selling for pennies on the dollar. They try to collect face value from you, and they try to tell you that you have a moral obligation to pay them 100%. But when they're selling it to investors, they're willing to sell it for, on average, 4 cents on the dollar.
Holy smoke. So I just find that to be shocking news. 4 cents on the dollar.
All right, so continue. So these people then buy the debt, and then they call around and try to get people like you and me to pay what we owe. And how successful are they on average?
Well, you know, I wish I had the exact statistic in front of me, but these are highly, highly profitable investment firms. I mean, the industry as a whole is a multi-billion-dollar industry every year. And it's basically a system that is predicated on tricking people into believing that they have a moral obligation to pay these debts. We don't have any moral obligation to pay a debt that we were coerced into taking on in the first place for our basic needs. If somebody is hurt or sick, they deserve health care. That's a real obligation, a real moral obligation that we're currently defaulting on. But nobody should have to pay a debt that they were forced to take on for basic needs. Even things like credit card debt don't actually result from people who are buying flat-screen TVs or spending beyond their means. That's actually a very small portion of all credit card debt. We know that 40% of credit card debt went to pay for things like medical bills, rent, utilities, food. People who lose their jobs, as you know, we've had an unemployment crisis for the last several years, the only safety net that we have is credit cards. The bills keep coming, and the only way to pay for them is to go into debt. That's just unjust.
Wait, hold on here. You would agree, though, if you use a credit card to purchase something, you do owe the credit card company the amount that you spent.
Well, I would frame it within a larger context. If you were to chart worker productivity since World War II, that graph climbs at a 45-degree angle since World War II. Every single year, workers are producing more wealth. But if you were to also chart what the real income for workers has been since World War II, you can see it climbs after World War II and then levels off around 1980. So for the last 25 years or so, workers have been producing more wealth, but they haven't been taking home more of that wealth in their paychecks. But the costs of our basic needs have continued to rise. For example, university tuition has increased 1,000% since I was born, yet workers' real wages have been flat. So just meeting our basic needs, we have to use debt to make up that gap. So the real solution here isn't that people should just be buying everything on credit cards and then we don't have to pay it. The real solution here is higher wages for everybody, giving people the means to live. It's not that people have been living beyond their means. It's that we've denied them the basic means. Take the Walmart workers, for example, who have recently reached out to strike debt because many Walmart workers actually have Walmart credit cards, and they are in debt to Walmart. That debt is just covering their basic needs, which they can't do because Walmart is not paying them a living wage.
Now, looking at your website, Thomas, I see that you guys have raised $701,000 and have managed to abolish more than $14 million of debt. That is amazing. Where are you buying the debt that you're abolishing? How do you do this?
So the secondary market exists. It's out there. It's kind of hard to for a newcomer to figure it out or know how to get into it. It took us I started working on this project the first month of Occupy, and it took us over a year of dedicated research before we were ready to actually launch the project. But yeah, basically these debt buyers have a way to broker deals with each other, and because we were starting with medical debt, we were approaching some of the major investors who deal with medical debt, and we were directly approaching hospitals themselves, the billing departments at hospitals, and it's not too hard to get put in touch with the people who are in charge of selling off this debt.
Yeah, they may be eager to sell it to you, right? Because they don't expect to collect themselves. Now, as you go around and you try to buy this, are you trying to buy a specific debt that is owed by a particular person?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm glad you asked it, because on the one level, I would really love to be able to do that. We get emails all of the time from people who are just in very, very desperate situations. I would love to be able to go find their debt and abolish their debt, but unfortunately, there just isn't any way to do that. Individual debts get bundled into giant portfolios with tens of thousands of other people's debt. And all of that information is anonymous before you purchase it. We only learn whose debt we're buying afterwards. So it's sort of luck of the draw, a random act of mutual aid. We spent a lot of time trying to see if there was an innovative way that we could engineer more direct purchasing, but there just isn't.
Do you tell the people who benefit from this program that, hey, by the way, it was Rolling Jubilee who helped you out and canceled your debt, and you might think about paying it forward?
We don't ask people to pay it forward. We don't have any strings attached at all. In our view, they don't owe us anything. They shouldn't have owed anyone anything, for these medical debts shouldn't have existed in the first place. We do contact everybody. We send them a letter explaining that this particular bill is gone and they don't have to worry about it. And we encourage them to get in touch with us if they have any questions or, we want to hear their story if they're willing to share it. And we have heard from some of them, including one or two that have spoken to the media.
People must be ecstatic when they get that letter.
They're usually very pleased, but they're also very confused. I mean, part of the system is that the debt system is run on confusion. So a lot of times people get a medical bill and they'll say, I didn't know that this was still out there as an unpaid bill. I thought that my insurance company took care of this, or I thought that Medicare took care of this.
Yeah, I've experienced that myself.
Yeah, so it's a highly confusing situation, and then you add on top of it a project like the Rolling Jubilee, which is a bit unusual.
All right, so where does the Rolling Jubilee get its funds from?
Although we're no longer raising any new money, we were just raising money off of the internet. Our average donation was $40, and it's just come from people all around the country.
You say you're no longer raising new money. Do you not need any more money, or are you stopping the program?
The Rolling Jubilee was always designed to be a temporary tactic. It doesn't actually solve the problem of our debt crisis. What I think it does a really good job of doing is undermining this idea that we have a moral obligation to pay our creditors when our creditors are, in fact, exploiting us. And I think it does a good job of shining a spotlight on particular injustices and on the way that debt functions. We are going to spend the rest of the money that we've raised buying and abolishing more debt, and we're currently working on researching new debt to purchase. But once we've spent the last dollar, we want to move on to new tactics that are going to be more aggressive and that can target some of the structural problems that produce this debt in the first place. Although it's really great that we've been able to abolish nearly $15 million worth of medical bills, that's just a drop in the bucket. There's $1.2 trillion worth of student debt out there. There's about $800 billion worth of credit card debt out there. What we're doing, it can't scale up and it can't solve the problem. So we want to move, we call it the Rolling Jubilee because it needs to roll into larger tactics.
You say that people are buying debt, medical debt in this case, for 4 cents on the dollar. Are these individuals who are doing this, or are they companies and organizations?
In most cases, these would be organizations. These are investment firms who, venture capitalists will give them money to go out and buy debt. In fact, in many cases, it's the banks themselves that are financing the debt buying industry. So a credit card company will sell off every month all of the debt that it wants to get off of its books, but it'll sell it to a debt-buying company that it itself is lending all of the capital to buy the debt. So they're still making money off of it as it goes into collection.
When you buy somebody's debt, and we understand that you're not just buying one person's debt, you're buying a whole pool of debts that the hospital is selling to you. When the hospital sells that, they report to the credit agency or multiple credit agencies that so-and-so didn't make good on his debt. And so while you're erasing the debt, you're not pursuing it anymore, you're not fixing the other problem that is the credit report.
we're trying to address that as well. And there are a couple different ways we can do that. One is that in many cases, reports to the credit reporting agencies aren't made until the debt has already gone into collection and they've already given people at least one opportunity to try to pay it. They like using that as a threat. So if we can buy the debt before any reports are made, that's the best case scenario. Now, sometimes we can't do that. Sometimes reports have already been made. But when we purchase the debt, we put in our in the purchase agreement, and you can read these agreements on our website, rollingjubilee.org. We've got a transparency page where you can see the language that we put into the purchase agreement, where we say that the debt seller has to make a request to all of the credit reporting agencies to remove the trade line for each one of those debts. Now, it depends on each person's individual situation what the net effect of that will be. In some cases, it will help mitigate the damage that's already been done. But, you know, in other cases, we can't remove that damage entirely.
I'm curious about your philosophy when it comes to debt. Why do you believe that it's so bad for people to owe money and believe that they need to repay it?
Right. Our basic philosophy, I think, is that we want everybody to start asking the question, which debts do we really owe to each other? What are our true obligations to each other in a democratic society? I would argue that there are some debts that are just and other debts that are unjust. If you are willing to work hard and you get into a public university, your education doesn't just benefit you, it benefits all of us. I would say that I have a real debt to make sure that you get an education, and it's those kinds of debts that we're defaulting on. But as a society, we have more than enough wealth in order to produce free public education for everyone who needs it. In fact, Strike Debt has crunched the numbers, and it's quite affordable to provide to make every public university free. I have a real obligation to you that if you get sick or hurt, you should get health care. What would be an unjust debt would be taking advantage of somebody who's down on their luck and making a payday loan that has 485% interest. That would be exploitative debt and or odious debt. And it's our view that if you make a critical examination of all of the debt in the world, the vast majority of it is of the odious variety. But there are real debts that we should pay. And in most cases, we're not paying those.
So you think there are some debts that are owed and some debts that are not. Which debts are owed and which debts are not?
Right. And in a democratic society, we should all be making those decisions together. A good way to illustrate this is that Detroit right now is going through a bankruptcy process. And there is one person who is deciding which debts get paid and which debts don't get paid. His name is Kevin Orr, and nobody elected him. And in many cases, he's making, just about all the cases, he's making the wrong decisions. He's saying that Wall Street investors should be paid off first, and pensioners should be defaulted on. Mm. We would encourage a different approach where the people are making these decisions. Which debts should be paid and which debts should be refused.
But in fairness, Thomas, the people of Detroit had many years to make the right choices, and they failed, and that's why the city is in bankruptcy. And I don't know intimate details about the bankruptcy proceedings.
Well, I would say that there's many, many factors involved. One is that I would agree with you that there has never been a vibrant democratic system in Detroit or in many of our cities. But you have to look at Detroit within the context of global capitalism, free trade agreements, deep and lasting racism from the 1970s, the white flight. It's not that people in Detroit were irresponsible in their decisions. It's largely that these forces have been outside of their control, just like this bankruptcy process.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.